We're in Ezekiel 38, back in Ezekiel 33 and verse 21. Really, the last hope for the exiles is gone. Remember that the people, mostly who are hearing for the first time Ezekiel's message, they're exiles. They're away, far away from Jerusalem. And in chapter 33, they learn that the city has been flattened by the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. And their last hope really has been taken away, it would seem. That's followed, chapter 33 is followed by those chapters with such great comfort and promise for God's people. There have been promises all the way through the book of Ezekiel, but they really intensify after the news that Jerusalem has fallen. There's the shepherd king spoken about in chapter 35, that compared with the terrible shepherds that God's people had in their rulers, there was going to be the shepherd of God, and they would be united under one king. There would be restoration. There would be grace for God's people, and that would be a witness to the world. We see that there. We see that into chapter 36 as well. And then in chapter 37 that we looked at last week with Peter, seemingly hopeless, lifeless bones become a vast army. And in that chapter, the promises again are brought forward about the Spirit. It's already been spoken about in Ezekiel. And the kingdom under one king. New life through the Spirit, God's people under one king. Chapters 38 and 39, they continue that theme of great comfort, but with quite unusual, you might even say disturbing words about invading armies. Really, when you first read chapter 38, and maybe when the people first started to hear the words of chapter 38, you think, oh no, here we go again. There's judgment coming. It's going to be even worse. But as we work through those chapters, there's surprising conclusions. I think in the bulletin and the plan, it says that I'm preaching from chapter 39, but really, 38 and 39 go together. 38 runs through a story, and 39 pretty much repeats the same story, but with some extra details. So, let's do a quick fly past. Chapter 39 is the one we're going to focus on, but it's really a rerun of chapter 38. So, the quick fly past of these two chapters is this. Gog, he's a king, it's not a misspelling of God. Gog of the land of Magog, he leads an alliance of many nations from the north, and they come and they attack an unsuspecting Israel who are living in peace in their own land. But the Lord is controlling these events, in fact, hooking this king in order to drive him in this direction. Rather than carrying off a massive plunder from Israel, they receive a massive defeat and they're slain. And that's accompanied by what you might call cosmic phenomenon, earthquake, plague, blood, fire, hail, brimstone. It will take Israel 7 months to bury the dead, because there's so many of them. There will be scavenging birds and beasts who will eat their fill. There will be captured weapons of war that will provide firewood for 7 years. And the end result will be that both Israel and the nations will know conclusively that the Lord, that word Yahweh, is God, and that these historical events, the exile, the restoration, the judgment, they were all God's doing. And the Lord promises that his greatness, his holiness, his glory will finally and fully be revealed. That's a fly past of the two chapters. Let's just see that played out through those chapters. 38:1-9. The word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. prophesy against him and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says, I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and bring you out with your whole army, your horses, your horsemen fully armed, and a great horde with large and small shields, all of them brandishing their swords. Persia, Cush, and Put will be with them, all with shields and helmets, also Gomer with all its troops, and Beth-Togarmah from the far north with all its troops, the many nations with you. Get ready, be prepared, you and all the hordes gathered about you, and take command of them. After many days you will be called to arms. In future years you will invade a land that has recovered from war, whose people were gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which has long been desolate. They had been brought out from the nations, and now all of them live in safety. You and all your troops and the many nations with you will go up, advancing like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land. So we've got this grand alliance of many nations, some of the nations which we're not so sure about, just put that in the back of your mind for a minute. Some nations we know from other descriptions in the Bible who's being described. And they prepare for an invasion. It's like a storm, it's like a massive cloud, it's covering the land, verse 9. And they're led by Gog of the land of Magog, prince of Meshech and Tubal. Who is he? We'll think about that shortly. And they are to come against a peaceful, unsuspecting people. Verse 10, this is what the sovereign Lord says. On that day, thoughts will come into your mind, and you will devise an evil scheme. You will say, I will invade a land of unwalled villages. I will attack a peaceful and unsuspecting people, all of them living without walls and without gates and bars. I will plunder and loot and turn my hand against the resettled ruins and the people gathered from the nations, rich in livestock and goods, living in the center of the land. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish and all of her villages will say to you, have you come to plunder? Have you gathered your hordes to loot, to carry off silver and gold, to take away livestock and goods, to seize much plunder? And the invasion gets underway, and they advance with overwhelming numbers and force. Verse 14, therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to Gog, this is what the sovereign Lord says. In that day, when my people Israel are living in safety, will you not take notice of it? You will come from your place in the far north, you and many nations with you, all of them riding on horses, a great horde, a mighty army. You will advance against my people Israel like a cloud that covers in the land. Sorry, covers the land. In days to come, O Gog, I will bring you against my land so that the nations may know me when I show myself holy through you before their eyes. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Are you not the one I spoke of in former days by my servants and the prophets of Israel? At that time, they prophesied for years that I would bring you against them. This is what will happen in that day when Gog attacks the land of Israel. My hot anger will be aroused, declares the sovereign Lord. In my zeal and fiery wrath, I declare that at that time there shall be a great earthquake in the land of Israel. The fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the beasts of the field, every creature that moves along the ground, and all people on the face of the earth will tremble at my presence. The mountains will be overturned. The cliffs will crumble, and every wall will fall to the ground. I will summon a sword against Gog on all my mountains, declares the sovereign Lord. Every man's sword will be against his brother. I will execute judgment upon him with plague and bloodshed. I will pour down torrents of rain, hailstones, and burning sulfur on him and on his troops and on the many nations with them. And so I will show my greatness and my holiness, and I will make myself known in the sight of many nations. Then they will know that I am the Lord. The sovereign Lord had prophesied that this king or this army would come, he says. They attack. God's anger is aroused. We read about that. There's an awesome response with these cataclysmic events put in such exaggerated terms about all walls falling, an earthquake and so on, just to show the severity of the punishment and the judgment, and God's greatness will be seen by all the nations. That was so good. It gets repeated in chapter 39. First six verses. The Lord is against Gog as he summons him. Son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. I will turn you around and drag you along. I will bring you from the far north and send you against the mountains of Israel. Then I will strike your bow from your left hand and make your arrows drop from your right hand. On the mountains of Israel you will fall, you and all your troops and the nations with you. I will give you as food to all kinds of carrion birds and to the wild animals. You will fall in the open field, for I have spoken, declares the Lord. I will send fire on Magog and on those who live in safety in the coastlands, and they will know that I am the Lord. This will bring about a day when the Lord's name is known. He said that a lot, but he says it again in verses 7 and 8. I will make known my holy name among my people Israel. I will no longer let my holy name be profaned, and the nations will know that I, the Lord, am the Holy One in Israel. It is coming. It will surely take place, declares the Sovereign Lord. This is the day I have spoken of. And then verses 9 through 16, the land that the people invading wanted to occupy actually becomes where they die. It actually becomes where they're buried. It actually becomes their grave. Let's see that. Then those who live in the towns of Israel will go out and use the weapons for fuel and burn them up. The small and the large shields, the bows and the arrows, the war clubs and spears. For 7 years they will use them for fuel. They will not need to gather wool from the fields or cut it from the forest, because they will use the weapons for fuel. And they will plunder those who plundered them and loot those who looted them, declares the Sovereign Lord. On that day, I will give Gog a burial place in Israel. In the valley of those who travel east towards the sea, it will block the way of travelers, because Gog and all the hordes will be buried there. So it will be called the Valley of Hamon Gog. For 7 months, the house of Israel will be burying them in order to cleanse the land. All the people of the land will bury them, and the day I am glorified will be a memorable day for them, declares the Sovereign Lord. Men will be regularly employed to cleanse the land. Some will go throughout the land, and in addition to their mothers, will bury those that remain on the ground. At the end of the 7 months, they will begin their search. As they go through the land and one of them sees a human bone, he will set up a marker beside it until the grave diggers have buried in the valley of Hamon Gog. Also, a town called Hamonah will be there, and so they will cleanse the land. And then, verse 17 onwards, there's this shocking feast in the sort of style of a banquet. But bear in mind that it's pretty shocking to us. But it would have been even more shocking to Ezekiel, because they're violating all the ceremonial food laws in what's going on here. It's almost, some commentators said, in a sort of cartoon, ridiculous, macabre, sort of black humor style, as it's described. Verse 17, Son of man, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. Call out to every kind of bird and all the wild animals. Assemble them and come together from all around the sacrifice I am preparing for you, to the sacrifice I am preparing for you, the great sacrifice on the mountains of Israel. There you will eat flesh and drink blood. You will eat the flesh of mighty men and drink the blood of the princes of the earth, as if they were rams and lambs, goats and bulls, all of them fattened animals from Bashan. At the sacrifice I am preparing for you, you will eat fat until you are glutted and drink blood till you are drunk. At my table you will eat your fill of horses and riders, mighty men and soldiers of every kind, declares the Sovereign Lord. Utter destruction of God's enemies, utter defilement of God's enemies. And again, why? So they would know he's the Lord their God. Verses 21 to 24. I will display my glory among the nations, and all the nations will see the punishment I inflict and the hand I lay upon them. From that day forward, the house of Israel will know that I am the Lord their God, and the nations will know that the people of Israel went into exile for their sin, because they were unfaithful to me, so I hid my face from them and handed them over to their enemies, and they all fell by the sword. I dealt with them according to their uncleanness and their offenses, and I hid my face from them. And then verse 25 to the end, a restored people, their former shame forgotten, The reasons for their exile understood, but their former shame forgotten. They're gathered back in the land. And God's face that was formerly hidden from them now becomes shown to them. And again, there's the outpouring of the Spirit, that great theme in Ezekiel of spiritual life. Therefore, verse 25, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. I will now bring back Jacob from captivity, and I will have compassion on all the land of Israel, and I will be zealous for my holy name. They will forget their shame and all the unfaithfulness they showed towards me when they lived in safety in their land, with no one to make them afraid. When I have brought them back from the nations and have gathered them from the countries of their enemies, I will show myself holy through them in the sight of many nations. Then they will know that I am the Lord their God. For though I send them into exile among the nations, I will gather them to their own land, not leaving any behind. I will no longer hide my face from them, for I will pour out my spirit on the house of Israel, declares the Sovereign Lord. Shall we go now? I wonder what you thought reading through that. Let me try and think together, help us think together about what does that mean and what does that mean for us? I think we need to understand a few basic things. Who is Gog from the land of Magog? Well, I'm here to tell you that nobody knows. Nobody really knows who he was or even if he was. There are various theories, but there's no real clarity on who he was. He was a king, at least in this description, of somewhere in the north. Maybe Magog was an area that's now called Lydia, that's in sort of Turkey, Greece area. The point is that they're really north. You know, like we might have used the expression in the past, kind of outer Mongolia, somewhere that we kind of had heard of, but we knew it was just so far away and completely outside of our experience. Probably outside of our experience even now, but the world is all a bit smaller. We can probably get a picture of it now on the internet. But just imagine somewhere that's so far away, outside of your experience, and in that sense, kind of exotic and mysterious and pretty scary. That's Gog from the land of Magog. Even worse than the Assyrians. Even worse than the Babylonians. Further north, further away, more obscure, more seemingly great and powerful, perhaps for their exoticness. He's a king then from the obscure north. And I think he's purposely obscure because in some way or other, which we think about, he symbolizes nations, peoples, organizations, ideologies in opposition to God's people. I think he's purposely obscure, a bit like Melchizedek, in a different context, but you know, Melchizedek, don't know quite background and who he was and so forth, because he was supposed to be showing something more than he was. Sometimes people kind of who are real and are known and historical in the Old Testament symbolize something for us. Sometimes they're purposely obscure, so they can more readily symbolize a lot of things and a lot of ideas. I think that's what's happening with Gog. How is this attack going to happen? You know, what's this all about? So we know there's this obscure king. How is it going to happen that this all takes place? Well, here are some options. It could be that nations attack God's people in Israel. Either they did it sometime in the past, you know, 323 BC, some king from the north did attack, and that all kind of went down as is described here. Or it could be that there will be invaders to Israel in the future as part of the end of history. Maybe it'll be all the Arab nations surrounding the new state of Israel, newish, 1948, kind of re-establish. So that could be one option. It could be attacks on Christian countries or on the sort of Christianity in general. Augustine, He thought when the Goths, and they're not people that wore kind of makeup and had dyed hair, but a whole race of people, maybe they did wear makeup and have dyed hair as well, but and listen to kind of thrash music. Do Goths listen to thrashy music? I don't know what. Anyway, not those kind of Goths, real Goths, who attacked Rome along with maybe the Vandals and the various other barbarians. Augustine thought they were Gog and Magog because they were kind of attacking what was then a sort of Christian state and empire. Luther, Martin Luther, great reformer, he thought it was the Turks, which is not so ridiculous because the geography is about right. And he's thinking, obviously there was the great Ottoman Empire, a great Islamic empire, generally speaking. And they had great influence and they attacked, in some ways, God's people and pushed back places where there was at least nominally Christianity. Some people think that it was communism in the early part of last century. Actually, one of the translations of Gog, who is king of those two areas, Meshech and Tubal, there is a translation that there's something like king of Rosh. What does Rosh sound like? It sounds a bit like Rosha, if you say it with a sort of polo in your mouth or something. So some people thought it's Rosha, and maybe sort of Meshech sounds a bit like Moscow. So maybe it's that. And I'm sure there will be other theories too. You could speculate about whether Islam now has the closest correspondence as it today attacks nations sometimes and the church. Maybe in some sense all those ideas were true. But I think they're all part of a greater spiritual opposition, which is really going on throughout history and kind of hoarding and massing and growing and sort of building against God's people, led by the devil, attacking God's people throughout history. Now, maybe that comes to some great climax. I don't really want us to get lost with, is there a particular kind of historical end to this? Is it somehow bound up with some growing opposition? I think it's, as really has been shown by these people who thought it was particular nations, it's rather foolish and can be quite embarrassing trying to predict what's going on. I think the Gog is purposely obscure, to take us really to think this is about the opposition to God's people throughout history. There are these formidable enemies who alliance themselves against God's people, and what they herald eventually is not the destruction of God's people. The people were dwelling securely in the land. They've been delivered from the exile. They're not destroyed. What happens? God's judgment rains down. And I think whatever kind of mini judgments happen on the way, we're really taken in these chapters to God's final judgment at the end of history. When God wraps up this stage of history and ushers in the age to come, that's the judgment that happens here. I think things are described in such a cataclysmic way, such a dramatic way, such a final way, such a devastating way. You know, why is all their stuff about the bodies being buried for so long and all the firewood and all the desecration and everything? It's because it is so full and so final and so complete, and the armies are so devastated and they are buried and they have to be accounted for because there is justice and there is complete comprehensive judgment. That must take us to God's final judgment. And it takes us to the end, where, what was it like for God's people? They're completely secure. You see, at the cross of the Lord Jesus Christ, our sin is paid for. And it's a bit like we're the returning exiles. Our sin has been atoned for, but not by our exile, but by Jesus' exile. And we're living in the land, in a sense, we're spiritually there. We're living in the land at peace. But we're still under attack by the world and our own flesh and the devil, all these alliances. And although they appear powerful and numerous and formidable, unbeatable at times, God intervenes throughout history with little judgments, but he will intervene fully and finally, and nothing that has been done, none of these attacks, will destroy God's people. I think we're helped if we have a quick look at Revelation chapter 20. Have a look there at verse 8. That's bad, isn't it? I'm struggling to find the book of Revelation. It's somewhere near the end. Revelation 20 and verse 8. You've got a marker in there ready for me. When 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. It's the only other place where they're mentioned. To gather them for battle. In number they are like the sand on the seashore. They marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loved. But fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophets had been thrown. They will be tormented day and night forever and ever. I think that really helps to kind of nail it for us, doesn't it? Gog and Magog in Ezekiel, they're taking us to the final judgment. As throughout history, perhaps culminating in some big way, I'm not sure, but throughout history, God's enemies amass. There's loads of them. They seem to be so formidable, but God will judge fully and finally. And as we read there in the book of Revelation, it will happen at the end. There it's at the end of the 1,000 years, the millennium, which, as we thought about a month ago, there are different ideas about. But at the end of that time, which we believe is the church age, the gospel age, the days we're living in now, at the end of that time, there will be the final judgment and conclusion of God's purposes for history. So that's what Ezekiel's doing. He's looking right into the distance. In a way, he kind of looks through the cross to the end. That happens a bit in the Old Testament. We need to get used to that idea that sometimes in the Old Testament, they don't kind of look in perfect sequence through the cross and the church age and the end. They just look and they see the last days all sort of conflated into one thing. They see the cross and they see the end kind of as one. And that's what's going on here. Ezekiel sees through to the end. He sees that although God's people have sinned, their sin has been paid for, they are completely secure, and God will judge fully and finally all his enemies. And in the end, God will have all the glory, and his people will know who he is and that he's for them, and sin will be completely dealt with. So if that's what it means, that it's about an alliance of forces against the church, attacking God's people throughout history, if it means that this will bring about, finally, the judgment of God, which will be complete and comprehensive, what does that mean then for us? The book of Ezekiel is written to God's people to assure them that God's on the throne. They'd have loads of doubts about that, wouldn't they? They're exiled, most of them who are hearing this word, and their city's just been flattened. Wouldn't you think God's not on the throne? But the book is written to assure them that God's on the throne and God is judging, but he will also bring about gracious purposes. The book of Revelation is written to a church who is feeling vulnerable and weak and under attack and feeling like there are such powerful forces amassing against them. Mysterious, obscure, exotic forces that seem so powerful amassing against them. And how will they stand? And Ezekiel and John in the book of Revelation are saying to us, the church is always going to be under attack. Don't be surprised that God's people always face formidable enemies. Sometimes physical persecution, sometimes ideological and spiritual battles, sometimes just the battles with our own hearts and our own waywardness and sinfulness. The church is always under attack, but God's enemies will be judged. God's enemies will be judged. Verse 21 says, I will display my glory among the nations, and all the nations will see the punishment I inflict and the hand I lay upon them. Whoever opposes God is going to lose. And the judgment will be catastrophic and devastating. God's enemies will be judged. What does that mean? Well, on the one hand, it means that we feel secure and that we know that God's enemies won't ultimately triumph. Whatever ideology there is, whatever we feel kind of weak in front of as a church, whatever bad laws there are, whatever military forces invade us and try and impose something on us, whatever happens, God's enemies will be judged. They will not triumph. So it means we feel secure. But it also means we want to urge people not to alliance themselves with Gog and Magog of the land of Magog. We were talking about relevant things we could say to our friends this morning, you know, from the news. And maybe you can say to your friends tomorrow, don't form an alliance with Gog. That would really translate well, wouldn't it? Don't form an alliance with Gog. At least they might say, what do you mean? But finding our own words, if you really believe that the judgment is going to be that devastating, you'd want to urge people not to be part of that, wouldn't you? You know, it's, I don't know how it felt as you were reading it, but or listening to me reading it, but it is so gross, so purposely shocking, the amount of carnage and desecration. You're supposed to kind of, in your mind, imagine it. And these piles of bodies are blocking the way. And they're all buried, and the people are finding bones and having to bury them because everyone needs to be buried. And it's all desecrated, and there's birds eating the flesh and everything else. You're not supposed to say, oh, I don't like that very much. You're supposed to say, wow, this is God's judgment. It's not going to be like that. It's going to be worse. You think that's bad? Really, when God judges, it's going to be awful. And why would you want to be part of that? And why would you want anyone to be part of that? Wouldn't you want to urge people not to be part of that? Now, I know we need to find a way in. There's no point, actually, us saying, don't form an alliance with God. Don't go to hell. You can't just start there. We know that because it will mean nothing to people. It might sound gracious and kind, but it's just obscure and eccentric. So we know we've got to find a way in. But part of the motivation for finding a way in and saying, well, look, will you study this book, Luke's Gospel, with me? Or will you come to the church? Or will you come around my house and let me just share something about my testimony? The reason we do that is because we don't want them to experience God's judgment, do we? You're all right, most of you. I'm all right in God's grace and God's goodness. We're thankful for that. We're so joyful about that. But we must care that the hordes, the masses, joining forces to attack God. They laugh about God. They laugh about Jesus. They think we're a bunch of loonies. They think that we're eccentric and we're outdated and that this book is just one of many. They think all this. They seem powerful and formidable, and they're just going to be flattened, and we should care. Because it's no good opposing God. God's enemies will be judged. Judgment, though, just bear this in mind, it's essential for heaven to be heaven. Apart from emphasizing the severity of the judgment, all this burial stuff, I don't know if you noticed, but it was about cleansing the land, wasn't it? It was about the land being clean, so the people could live there in a clean land. Heaven won't be heaven if there isn't the judgment of God. I think we'll be thinking about that next time with Nick as well. But it's worth kind of registering that and pondering on that, perhaps in the week to come, before we look at it again. Because sometimes we think, I don't like the idea of the judgment of God, because it's going to be painful for some of my friends and family. And does it have to be like that? You want to live with God, free from sin, there has to be judgment. Our sins have to be paid for at the cross or paid for in the end. You want to live in a place where there is no more tears, no more crying, and no more pain. You want to live in a place that you will not die in. Then there needs to be judgment, and there needs to be cleansing, and there needs to be separation. So judgment's essential for heaven to be heaven. God's people, though, will be restored there. So there will be judgment, there will be cleansing, and we will be God's people there, knowing that the Lord is for us. That's emphasized at the end of chapter 38 and right through, really, but particularly at the end of chapter 39. I will no longer hide my face from them. Just think about that, the New Testament idea that we will see him face to face. It's the idea of intimacy and acceptance, isn't it? No longer will I hide my face from them. By implication, I will show my face to them. We will see him face to face, and we will be like him. God's people will be restored. And in heaven, we will forget our shame. That's the sense, really, of Israel, that they will know, and the nations will know that there was a reason for their exile, but that's forgotten now. They will know that although I send them into exile, verse 28, I send them into exile, I will gather them from the land, not leaving them behind, and I will no longer hide my face from them, and I will pour out my spirit on them. There will be a new beginning for God's people, and they will know that they've been saved from their sin, but they will no longer live under the shadow of their sin. God's people will be restored. And lastly, God's glory will be seen, his glorious holiness. Verse 21, I will display my glory among the nations. Many times repeated, they will know that I am the Lord. Again, repeated, they will know that I, the Lord, am holy in the land. All these events will result in glory to God, a recognition that God is separate, he is different, he is distinct, he is sovereign, he is supreme, he is transcendent, he is God, he is gracious. All these things will be revealed, and we will say, what a great God. You see, salvation, of course it is for our rescue. We are rescued. But what's the purpose of salvation? Is the purpose so we're rescued? No, the purpose is that we're rescued for the glory of God. God will display his glory in us. It's an amazing thing that through God's people, through them, the glory of God will be displayed. It's mentioned there in Ezekiel. We see that in the New Testament as well, that idea that through God's people, the glory will be displayed, not even just through the kind of acts of God, and not even just through the Lord Jesus Christ, although he is obviously the supreme demonstration of the glory of God, but in the church, the glory of God is being displayed. But that's why we're here. Not just to get to heaven, but to live for God's glory, because that's what we were made to do, and that's what we're happiest doing. And all the world will one day recognize that. There's nobody that you meet in your life who will not one day recognize that. Absolutely nobody. Think of everyone you've ever met in your life. Think of all the people you know now who are not Christians. Don't think for one second that they're not going to know. Everybody will know the glory of God. And everybody will know that this people, the church, God's people, that their sin was dealt with and they're safe and secure. And everyone will know that the Lord is holy and the Lord is judge. Everyone will know that. Think about that. as you're talking with people. God's glory and his holiness is being displayed in the church now, but it will be seen by everybody one day. And we want more and more people to see it right now in the church, in the face of Jesus Christ.